If you're happy with the same old ways of dating,
if you enjoy sucking at communication,
and you have no desire to improve your romantic life, then our podcast might not be for you.
But if you want some out-of-the-box ideas to deepen your current relationships,
broaden your sexual horizons,
develop a better understanding of yourself,
or learn more about non-monogamy,
then you've come to the right place. I'm Jace.
I'm Emily.
And I'm Dedeker.
And this is the Multiamory Podcast. On this episode of the Multiamory Podcast, we are speaking with Kerry Jenkins, philosopher and author of the new book, What Love Is and What It Could Be. We had a great conversation about the nature of love, including non-monogamous love. Of course, she is a poly person herself. And we talked about its biological nature, as well as its social nature, and some of her predictions for the future. It was an awesome conversation.
Yeah, excellent, excellent. And yeah. Wonderful read also.
Yeah, definitely recommend checking out the book. There'll be information at the end of the podcast and in our notes where you can get the book and where you can learn more about Kerry. All right, with that, let's get to it.
So we have Kerry Jenkins here, author of the book What Love Is and What It Could Be. Thank you so much for joining us on the show, Kerry.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
So, rather than us just like reading your bio off and your list of accomplishments, do you mind just letting our listeners know a little bit about yourself, about what it is that you do?
For sure. Yeah. So I'm a professor of philosophy at the University of British Columbia, and I have the Canada Research Chair in philosophy at that university. And I'm running a project there, which is a multi-year interdisciplinary project on the nature of love, the metaphysics of romantic love. So I'm looking into just what this thing is, questions like how natural it is, how much of it is invented versus discovered, whether it's real at all, and questions like that. And so so the book that I've just written, What Love Is and What It Could Be, has come out of that project at the University of British Columbia.
So I have a question, and this isn't really even about the main topic at hand, but it's about the term metaphysics that you used.
Oh, yeah.
You know, in the book, you give a little bit of a definition about it. And it's an interesting one because I find that a lot of people in the non-monogamy community also tend to be involved with stuff that's a little bit, we call it, you know, like hippie or a little woo-woo.
We call it woo-woo. Yeah.
And people in that, like in the New Thought movement and stuff like that, use the term metaphysics as well. And I think they're meaning something different than what you are.
That's right. Yeah. So metaphysics has many different meanings. The way I'm using it is the way that an academic philosopher uses it. So it's within the discipline of philosophy. It's a sub-discipline that is particularly concerned with reality, with the nature of the world and the universe around us, as opposed to, say, like questions of ethics or questions about how we know about the world, which would be epistemology. So metaphysics is really kind of those direct questions about what is real and what isn't. And so it's not like that usage is obviously not completely disconnected from other ways that people use the term metaphysics, which also tend to be interested in that question about like what's real and what isn't. But certainly it has different connotations. When you go into most bookstores and look at the metaphysics section, you're probably not looking at
it. Tends to be like
about
the secret and the sort of magical
sort
esoteric of stuff.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, that's right. It doesn't really mean that in the academic context.
Right.
So for your book that just came out, for all the lay people, like non-philosopher people who are listening out there, essentially it boils down to this really excellent and very thorough exploration of trying to figure out what romantic love really is. And so, Kerry, now, why is that such a tricky question for us to tackle?
Yeah, great question. So, I mean, there are lots of things getting in the way of understanding this, I think. So there's this bundle of ideas, ideologies that I've called the romantic mystique, And I'm using that label very deliberately to call back to the feminine mystique, this idea that Betty Friedan was developing as a sort of core principle of second wave feminism, that women or femininity have been bundled as mysterious and weird and incomprehensible, but very natural and like spiritual and mystical maybe, and then sort of put on a pedestal. In that, with that bundle of ideas and ideologies floating around what it is to be a woman. And the thought then is you can't really question that or challenge that, and if you want to live a fulfilling life as a woman, you just accept your role as a maternal caregiver and nurturer, because that is what is bundled into these natural ideas. So that's the feminine mystique. And I want to say there is this other phenomenon, the romantic mystique, where we're attaching a very, very similar bundle of ideas and ideologies to romantic love. So, for example, this idea that it's incomprehensible, it's mysterious and weird, you can never really understand it, but it's wonderful and beautiful and magical and natural, and so you can put it on this little pedestal, you should never critique it, you should never challenge it, and if you want to live a fulfilling life, you should just let it happen the way it is, and then, you know, everything will just work out. And so, like the feminine mystique, this romantic mystique is this really disempowering ideology. It's promoting acquiescence. It's promoting deliberate ignorance of what I think is actually really, really powerful, really influential, potentially really dangerous, potentially deadly phenomenon, right? Which is romantic love. Yeah. So that we've got this combination of things going on, where on the one hand, lots of people are literally letting their lives be determined by romantic love. Mm-hmm. And on the other hand, everyone's saying, well, don't overthink that. You just want to let that happen, uh-huh. right? You can't really understand it, so that's fine. And I'm saying, no, that's not fine. If it's that important, we need to do the best we can to understand it. And of course, we can never fully understand it. We're not going to answer the question perfectly, but we've got to try.
Right. Yeah.
So that actually leads me perfectly to one of our later questions, which is the fact that, and you mentioned this in the book, that when you bring up analyzing romantic love or using any kind of analytical or logical tool with love, that people sometimes freak out a little bit. You know, they kind of think like, oh, that's gonna make it less romantic. That's gonna take away the magic. That's gonna make it inorganic. And we've definitely experienced in our own lives, you know, trying to use different tools and relationships or communication tools of people being like, oh, that's so robotic. Like, why would you do it that way? And we've always felt on the podcast that it actually can enhance things, you know, rather than make them more robotic. But mm-hmm. I want to know, what's your response to that? Because I feel like a lot of people would respond to this book in that way of like, why do you want to pick apart romantic love? Like, isn't that going to destroy all of our relationships?
Yeah, good. So, I mean, it didn't destroy mine. So, you know, that's the first thing to put on the table. It didn't destroy either of my like long-term loving relationships. In fact, I feel that it's made them stronger and healthier to be more thoughtful and to be more aware. The other thing to say about this is sometimes there's perceived to be a kind of dualism or dichotomy between emotion and reason, this idea that you're either thinking or you're feeling, and they're going to somehow be pulling you apart. And what I found is that with practice and over time, they're pulling me together. And that, I think, is really valuable. So I'm not proposing to replace feeling through one's romantic relationships with thinking instead. I'm proposing to try to bring, you know, in a really healthy mind, I'm thinking, can't we bring those two together so that they're working in harmony and they're pulling in the same direction? Rather than trying to shut part of that down, rather than trying to shut one's critical reasoning self down, at the very moments when you might need it the most, right? Yeah. When perhaps things could be dangerous.
I wanted to go into that a little bit, because an example that I thought was really powerful in your book is when you're talking about how if we don't question what love is and we're just kind of taking this sort of amalgamation of little clues we get from the movies we watch and the books we read and all of that, that we can end up not being able to tell the difference between abuse and love, because a lot of those traits are misrepresented, or you know, that's why when you were mentioning earlier that it can be dangerous or even deadly, I'm like, yeah, right. We've all seen this happen with ourselves and with people that we care about.
And this is an idea that I'm taking straight out of Bell Hooks, who's one of the big influences on my work. She's been, you know, a long time critic and feminist writer, and she's very interested in love and the nature of love. I don't agree like wholly with all of her views, but there is that strand in particular was really inspiring to me in wanting to come to clarity, as she puts it, about what love is. Precisely because the unclarity is allowing a lot of dangerous and dark things to fly under the banner of love. And that's such a powerful and positive banner that it's actually, you know, it's a very dangerous thing to let something that's actually destructive, something that's actually abusive, fly anywhere near the word love, right?
Yeah.
So phrases like, you know, too much love as used to excuse abusive behavior, I think those just need to set our alarm bells ringing immediately and very loudly.
Well, what it makes me think of is not necessarily abuse, but I think of the reactions that we often get when we on the podcast talk about NRE, about new relationship energy.
Oh, yeah.
You know, about that, you know, that rush of energy that you get when all the chemicals in your brain are firing when you first start to fall in love with someone. And I feel like understanding that NRE is a thing makes it better. Like the fact that I can be like, okay, now I can soak into this and I can enjoy it.
But also not make any major life decisions.
But not make a decision to move across the country, you know? But so many people don't, you know? So many people do totally fall into that. Yes. I mean, and I've had, like, I've even had partners who are like, why would you call it NRE? Like, that's just so inorganic and, like, that's so unromantic. But it's, yeah, I feel very much the same that, no, like, I feel like it. Being able to bring in the thinking mind enhances it and makes it so that you can enjoy it without like just being like totally drunk, I suppose.
There were parts when in reading the book that reminded me a little bit of the show Cosmos of Neil deGrasse Tyson, where he talks a lot about, you know, critics of scientific exploration of the universe say like, oh, you're taking the magic out of it. You're taking the God out of it, whatever. And his argument is always like, don't you see how much more incredible this is when we understand it? And I kind of felt a little bit of a similarity in your book in terms of exploring love and looking at the different studies that are done about it and the writers over the years who've talked about it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, my sense is that understanding things better in no way takes out the magic or the wonder. You know, it's the wonder that prompts me to understand and that gets me down these rabbit holes of just thinking, what on earth is going on here that's so complicated and beautiful and brilliant? And that's why I'm going to investigate it, right? Yeah. So it's, I don't see those things as being intention at all. Yeah. I wanted to come back to actually one of the things that you said about the word unromantic, like the idea that doing this kind of critical thinking could be unromantic. And I think there might actually be something to that, but not something that we want to be too worried about doing. So here's my thought. So sometimes when we use the word romantic, we're using it to pick out a particular kind of story that we have singled out as the romantic story, and it's basically, you know, just the plot of every rom-com ever. That story we think of as romantic, and the label then gets used to kind of distinguish it from every other kind of story, every other kind of relationship that could happen. And so sometimes when we say unromantic, what we're doing is we're investing in that hierarchy that makes some love stories the romantic ones and therefore the best ones.
Right.
And so unromantic, in some ways, it might even be worth trying to reclaim a little bit of that and say, sure, it's not your rom-com stereotype.
Right.
That does not mean we've done something wrong here. And, you know, I mean, this is kind of getting me a little bit ahead of ourselves in where I go in the book, but part of what I end up saying in this book is I'm not even sure whether my love does count as romantic. And I'm not sure if I'm worried about that because that might not be what I'm after in the long term.
Well, that's a good pivot point because I mean, part of the reason why we invited you on the show is because you yourself have been involved in non-monogamous relationships for quite a while. And I would want to know, like, why is this question and why is this exploration relevant to people who are non-monogamous or polyamorous?
Right. So, I mean, this was part of the motivation behind getting into this question. It was kind of a really interesting smushing together of my professional interests and my personal life. So I had been working in metaphysics for a long time and thinking about the nature of reality and what's real and what's out there and what's natural and what does it even mean to say that something's natural and all that sort of stuff. But I hadn't been applying those questions to love specifically until I started living in openly polyamorous relationships and noticing that, you know, how I was experiencing love was definitely non-standard, was not normative around in the place around me. So, and one of the things that would happen that was symptomatic of that would be that people would say, that's not really love. You're not really in love if you feel it with two people because, you know, because they're thinking of the single romantic story that's definitely monogamous and permanent and, you know, all of those other things. And so for me, part of the process of the book, which is still represented as, you know, as you read through the book, you can kind of see me struggling through these questions. Part of the process is asking, well, if I do love two people, does that mean it's not romantic love? Is there something different? Is there a different category that would have to fall into? And I end up, you know, developing my own theory of what romantic love is that gives a kind of yes and maybe answer. And so, I mean, possibly I should explain a bit more about what that theory is before I explain why it delivers that answer. Mm-hmm. But one of the things I end up saying is that, you know, even if the answer was no or maybe, that wouldn't necessarily mean I was doing something wrong.
Mm-hmm. Right. I mean, I feel like we could easily just sort of like go through your whole book and all of the, you know, all of the different arguments made along the way and different explorations there. But I think that this point, in terms of stuff that we've talked about on this podcast, the point that really resonated with some stuff we've been on is that idea of, does my relationship count as romantic love? And maybe it doesn't matter if it does or not. Mm-hmm. And kind of asking these questions of, why do we feel the need to make this separate category for romantic love, mm-hmm. versus having love, having sexual attraction, having, you know, cohabitation, having commitment, having all these different pieces. And you described it in your book at one point as a la carte, like the idea that you're picking which pieces is going to go into this relationship. And I love that because I've been looking for a good way to describe that. And the metaphor of an a la carte menu is awesome. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Yeah, I like this idea. And the idea that you can go back to the buffet and, you know, you can get something else that you didn't get the first time. You can swap things out if it's mm-hmm. not working for you. You know, you don't have to go just once and then you keep whatever's on your plate.
Mm-hmm. Right. That just because a relationship's romantic doesn't mean it has to have all of these pieces.
Mm-hmm.
So something that I wanted to ask about. So early in the book, you talk about sort of the biological studies that have been done about the biology of love. And you talk specifically about Dr. Helen Fisher a fair mm-hmm. amount. And I was familiar with some of her work because of her TED Talks and, you know, other people writing about it and all that.
Dan Savage bashing her.
Well, that too. But so in it, you know, she did her study of college students who reported that they've recently fallen deeply in love and scanning their brains and seeing, oh, there's this, you know, dopamine and these sort of reward centers of their brain are being triggered. And the thing that struck me about it, because, you know, you mentioned that some of her conclusions may be affected by her own bias about how she thinks romantic love should be in terms of being monogamous or that it always follows the same trajectory. But I was actually thinking that it seems like even the setup of the experiment itself is based in that bias. Because in this situation, I would say it's fairly safe to assume that all of these people, all of these college students she was scanning, were in love with someone who they were probably having sex with or really wanted to. And it kind of made me ask this question of, like, how do we know that there's anything different between people saying they're in love, between people being incredibly sexually attracted to each other? And that why do we feel this need to make those one thing? To say, like, oh, well, if you're in love and there's this sexual attraction, then you're going to have these brain reactions. And it just kind of struck me as, like, what about asexual people? What if you scanned a group of 100 asexual people who've just fallen in love? Would that scan look different? And therefore, you know, the same question of, like, what's love then?
Right. So I'm so glad you raised this, because I actually have, I don't write about this so much in the book because it kind of gets into the specifics of scientific methodology. But I have another paper where this is an academic, you know, journal article, where I talk about the scientific research out of various disciplines that's being done on love, and the way that those studies are conducted. There's a lot of methodological reasons to worry quite deeply about what it is that they're showing us. And the point that you're making is exactly, I think, spot on, that because of the ways that the people are even being selected into the study in the first place, what they're most likely to show us is what normative love looks like,
right?
What we expect out of a romantic love story. I mean, even looking at this sort of college age group is going to be quite specific in ways that, you know, if you were to look at a bunch of 40 and 50 year olds, you might well expect to see something a
which is
different.
Actually, I found when I was in psychology classes in college, realizing how big a problem that is in a lot of psychological research out there, is that most of it's done on college students,
right?
Which is a very specific group,
very
of
specific
a socioeconomic group as well as an age group. Like, there's a lot of
yeah,
but it's just like the easiest,
right? Because your students
are just
free.
Right there,
they're free.
They're going to be, you know, they can be persuaded with
extra credit,
to come and take the. But of course, you know, that's a massive methodological problem. And so, I mean, that's one thing. And then, you know, another thing is that almost always the way that you are going to get your test group together is you're going to deliver some sort of questionnaire so that people can report on whether they're in love right now or not. Because how else are you going to know who is in your control group and who is in your test group? You just have to kind of ask them. And so that means you're relying on test questionnaires that are supposed to measure the symptoms of being in love. And I'm doing, people who are listening to this can't see, but I'm doing scare quotes with my fingers right now, the symptoms of being in love. But of course, who's designing that list of symptoms? It's actually been, there's a standard model test that's been designed by like some folks in the 80s for what the symptoms of being in love are like. And you know, that's obviously, in many ways, potentially a quite different phenomenon from love in 2017. Not least, I think the possibility of the very different ways that love is mediated now, especially in early stages, by technology and by different forms of communication that are being considered in something that was designed in the 1980s.
Yeah.
But the problem with this is that once a model has become the standard way of testing something, once you've got a standard measure for how much in love somebody is, then if you want your new study to be comparable to the older studies, you have to use the same measure. So that's why these things get very sticky. And actually, this is a big, big methodological problem for the science of love.
So it's kind of like these same benchmarks keep getting used when maybe the benchmark itself is not the best.
But what if the phenomenon has changed or there were problems with it originally? I mean, so one issue that I have with the standard measure that's used at the moment, it's called the passionate love scale, is that it just assumes that love is monogamous by definition. So it says things like, I would rather be with so-and-so than with anybody else, as a marker. And if you answer no to that question, you go down the scale of how in love you are. And I'm like, so that's going to put me straight down the scale of how in love I am just because I'm not a monogamous person.
Yeah, that's funny, because we did an episode on attachment theory quite a while ago. And I know there's similar things with attachment theory of where... people who answer like that they're jealous when they think about their partner being with someone else, that's actually a sign of like secure attachment, which is like so interesting,
very questionable, right?
Yeah.
Whose idea of attachment is that?
Yeah,
and that's
seriously,
that's the question, right? Whose idea of love is really being examined by these studies? And the answer is the people who've designed the studies. It's their idea of love, and so, you know, when we talk about someone like, say, Dr. Fisher being biased, there's a sense in which everybody is, right? Because nobody can come to these investigations without baggage and without assumptions. And you can't start without assumptions. You need them. But the thing you then have to do is be aware of what your baggage is, what your assumptions are. And the problem with some of these scientific studies is they're presenting as objective fact things that actually just encode somebody's idea about what romantic love is. And so they're concealing the relevance of those subjective takes on love, and presenting it as the objective truth. And that's where I have a methodological problem. You know, if you were to say, hey, look, this is a definition of love you could use. If you use that, then this is the results you get. Great. But if you then present that result as, and this is what love is, to core, for everybody, always and forever, then I think you've overstepped. I mean, the scientific method tells you not to do that, right? Yeah. You're overgeneralizing.
Yeah. I want to bring up something that you also explore in the book. It's this idea that historically people will label a relationship as being purely sexual as a way to devalue it. So, like, we saw this with interracial relationships. We've seen it with same-sex relationships. And we definitely see it with non-monogamous relationships, that it's, you know, no, that's not real love, it's just sexual. Of course, also putting, you know, love and sex on opposite ends of the scale. And what we've seen is, obviously, I think that what we saw in the gay rights movement was that big push towards, no, it's love. Like, it's love. Mm-hmm. It's hashtag love wins, you know, it's... We're just like you. We want to get married and have babies just like you. And I see that in the polyamory movement of being like, no, it's not all about sex. It's about love. You know, we also want to do child rearing and all these normal things. But what we kind of see is it's almost like the pendulum swings so far in the opposite direction that there's actually like a lot of sex negativity in the poly community as well. That it becomes so far that it's like, no, we're so not like the weirdos. Like, we actually think casual sex is a horrible thing, you know?
Yep.
Yeah, it is this challenging thing because it is, you know, like when we first started this podcast, you know, my best friend back in Seattle was like, I just don't understand why you need to talk about what happens in the bedroom on a podcast. And it was that thing of like, but it's not about that.
We're probably going to talk
about that. Right? Like, and so, you know, in our podcast, we intentionally don't talk a ton about sex on this podcast. Like, we mention that sex happens and talk about sort of the realities of it. But, you know, we don't do a lot of episodes just exploring sexuality. And part of that is because we did want to make it clear that monogamous people could be kinky and poly people could be kinky, but they don't have to go one with the other necessarily. But there is this risk of ending up fighting that fight too hard and ending up sex negative, or at least coming across
that way.
You're
so right. And so you're kind of giving me the perfect opportunity to talk about other things I've also written. I wrote a piece for The Establishment, which is a really great new media source that I love. I argue in it that, yes, it's true, polyamory is not all about sex, and media representation of it as a sort of hyper-sexualized phenomenon is a problem, because it is trading in the existing sex negativity for, you know, anti-poly sentiment.
Right.
But what I go on to say at the end of that is that the way to fight back about that needs to be done on two fronts, because you don't just like step away from the bomb and then push somebody else under it, right? What you do, you have to defuse the weapon at the same time as, you know, saving yourself from whatever damage is being done by it. So it is, you know, it is inaccurate to say that poly is all about sex. So of course, you know, we say that. At the same time, we don't want to say that without adding, also, there's nothing wrong with things that are all about sex, right? Because sex is fine, you know, unless there's something being done that's actually non-consensual or that's harmful. There is nothing wrong with purely sexual relationships. It's just that that isn't what I was talking about when I was talking about being in love with somebody, which is a different thing. So so it's kind of like, you know... It's sort of like somehow society has set aside the like shameful, dirty, nasty corner for the people who are all just about the sex and nothing else. And so, you know, everyone's trying to sort of run out of the dirty, nasty corner. And I totally get that. I understand like why that's important. But the other thing that's important is to like shine lights back into the corner and say, actually, there's nothing in there that's scary. Like that corner is actually fine too, and everyone back there is also fine. And you know, can we please just stop putting people in the corner?
But I guess what we've seen is that it's an easier battle to win pushing the "we're all about love" banner than to push the "no, look in the sex corner and you'll see that everything's fine."
Like, much easier, yeah, much easier. But it does, I mean, it doesn't make it right.
Yeah, you know? Exactly, exactly.
And it's kind of similar to, you know, the ways in which the norms of monogamy have actually been reinforced by the move towards like greater inclusion of same-sex love, as long as it is monogamous and looks as much as possible like traditional.
Yeah, yeah. As long as we're not talking about the bathhouse or anything like that. Yeah.
Exactly, right? As long as we're not talking about letting people have two partners, then we're cool with it. As long as you look as much like, quotes, us, as or normal as possible, then we're cool with it. And that's actually been, you know, one of the ways in which being a poly woman, and especially a queer poly woman, which is how I identify, has become like harder and harder, even as things have generally gotten better for queer people in general in the society around me. And in fact, the intersection becomes really awkward, because then being a queer poly person, you're kind of at, one of the phrases that I've seen bandied about is like ruining gay marriage for everybody, which is, you know, a piece of abuse that was actually sent to a queer triad.
Yes. I forget who it was, but there was someone, and I don't remember if this was more in the realm of philosophy or more about politics, but was talking about this, you know, basically the in-group out-group phenomenon, but basically that, you know, originally we have heterosexual monogamous people as the in-group, and then the out-group is queer people, is poly people, is kinky people, is everybody else, and they're all supporting each other. But then as soon as same-sex marriage gets to be in the in-club, now they disassociate themselves, you know, obviously not all the people, but sort of as a movement, right, as a whole, there tends to be this distancing because just like that, like you're ruining it for everybody.
Right? It's very strategic, and it can be, you know, politically savvy and all of these things, but, you know, it does amount to throwing somebody else under the bus to save yourself, and that's the part that I have a problem with. And so, you know, that's why, you know, when I write my polyamory is not all about sex article, it includes this final part that says yes, and things that are all about sex are fine, it's just that's not what it is. So it's kind of, you know, it's very difficult, because in some ways trying to save yourself from the misperception and from being like, you know, one of the people in the dark shady corner, it's very hard to make that move without reinforcing the shadiness of the corner you're stepping away from.
It's
getting easily misinterpreted as well.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to ChumbaCasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumba. ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
For a long time now, we've been fans of AdamandEve.com for getting sex toys or lingerie or accessories, things like that. It's just a fantastic resource with a huge selection. And now, not only do we have a fantastic offer, but we also have a promo code that will work on adammail.com and evestoys.com, which are their sites specifically for LGBTQ audiences. And our code is fantastic. It's 50% off of almost any item in the store and free discreet shipping when you use our code MULTI.
Yes, we love AdamandEve.com and have for years. They are our oldest and longest sponsor, and they just keep on giving great gifts to us and to our listeners. You can bring more pleasure and satisfaction into your bedroom by going to AdamandEve.com, AdamMail.com, or EvesToys.com and select any one item. It can be, you know, an adventurous new toy or anything you desire, something fun, something sexy, whatever sounds good.
So just enter offer code MULTI at checkout and you'll get 50% off almost any item plus free shipping. That's MULTI, MULTI, at adamandeve.com, adammail.com, or evestoys.com. This is an exclusive offer that is specific to this podcast, and it's better than any offer that is currently available on their site. So again, use code MULTI to get you not just the 50% discount, but also the 100% free shipping. Code MULTI.
Are you familiar with the philosophy of date your own species?
I think Reed Mihalko came up with it. I think it's his thing. I think he's the one who coined the term.
You mean as in like poly people should not date monogamous people?
Right. Along that same, those same lines. Yeah.
Or whatever it is, I guess. Okay. I guess it could apply to other
things. I think Neil Strauss picked it up also. But I think it's the sentiment is supposed to go beyond just like monogamous or polyamorous, but
yeah, like date people who are like you in terms of what you want instead of trying to convert other people or mm-hmm. something. I don't quite. So the reason why I bring it up is because in your book you were making a criticism of, you know, some arguments that people have made for reinforcing, reinforcing the sort of ban on interracial relationships or inter-religion relationships or whatever, where it's like, oh, you should just be attracted to your type. You know, right. like attracts like kind of a thing, except, of course, for gender.
Which is the... anyway.
But it was just interesting because you were making this criticism of, you know, of that argument of, saying that you should only stick with people that are like you. Mm-hmm. And it, for some reason, reminded me of Reed Mihalko's thing about dating your own species, which a lot of people in the poly community feel fairly positively about, where it's like, yeah, you know what? I'm a lot happier when I'm only dating poly people, or like, I won't date someone unless they're poly and they're already in at least one other relationship or something like that. And it's always rubbed me a little bit the wrong way. And when I read that section of your book, I was kind of like, oh, I wonder if there's something there that it's like one step away. It's like just adjacent to something that could be kind of toxic.
Yeah, good. So if you just replace species with race, then you can see immediately what the problem might be. Right. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. So I mean, here's a thought that might help us not to have to slide over that stuff too easily. So I mean, all of these kind of catchphrasey things are only as useful as what we can unpack from them when we start unloading what's behind the catchphrase. And so, you know, date your own species, if it's a prohibition on, like, you know, not raping animals, I mean, great, but of course that's not what it means, right?
If it's got some
some sort of reason why you would be happier with certain kinds of people, like say you want to have kids with someone, and so you're going to be happier with someone who also wants to have kids with you, then that makes a lot of sense, right? Because, you know, massive incompatibility on a huge life question like that is a real problem that you probably want to avoid, unless it can be outweighed by other things, which, you know, anything can potentially be outweighed by other things, but just as a rule of thumb. Whereas the kinds of situations I was talking about where, you know, we have seen at various points in history social policing to prevent dating or relationships or marriage outside of a socioeconomic group, outside of your race or religion, there would only be reasons to do that if there were reasons. You know what I mean? So, like, if you are very kind of devoutly committed to your religious beliefs and you want to have kids and you want to raise them in that religion, and being with someone else who is not of that religion is going to create like a huge obstacle for you, then that is a problem. Maybe it's one you can overcome or address, but it's still going to be a big thing that you would have to overcome or address. Whereas if you're just kind of telling people you can't date that person because you're white and they're black, then something has gone wrong, because that is not a reason. That's not a morally like viable reason not to date someone. And I mean, it's amazing to me that I didn't think about this in advance of my book coming out and some of the publicity around it, but it's been made clear to me because my partners are, one of them is Asian Canadian, the other is half white and half Asian American, that there's still such kind of potent and violent feeling about interracial love relationships out there. So, you know, some of the hate feedback that I get is racist, is just flat out racist. And so that kind of There is absolutely no grounds for anyone to be doing that. But there might be grounds for choosing a partner who like wants kids if you want kids, right? Yeah, so it all depends on what you mean.
But it brings me back a little bit to the a la carte thing. That what if you took the a la carte also to those sorts of things? So rather than this idea that to me the toxic part of it is that if I find someone else who's my own, quote, species, that means that somehow they're like the same as me in all the important ways. And it kind of sells short like the idea that we're all going to have little bits and pieces, and especially when you start looking at non-monogamy, where, like, if I really wanted to have children, maybe I could find a co-parent who I don't have to be romantic with, or even sexual with, for that matter.
Mm-hmm. Right? Sure.
So maybe they're not either your romantic and sexual species, but, like, they're your co-parenting species.
But they're your
co-parenting
species.
So then this whole idea of, like, the species just becomes sort of bullshit at that point, I feel like.
It becomes too crude a tool. We can say that, right? It's a very blunt instrument for something that requires a lot of subtlety and sophistication to apply. And so whenever you're doing that, you're at risk of doing the toxic thing by accident.
Of course. Mm-hmm. So we want to know, like, what do you see for the future? I mean, I know that these things do happen incrementally, but then at the same time, in our lifetimes, we've seen such amazing shift in attitudes towards same-sex relationships, towards interracial relationships. Obviously, as you've pointed out, like, there's still
a long ways to go.
But, like, what do you see for the future specifically of the way people look at very non-traditional love?
This is a tough one, and you know, in some ways I love predicting the future because no one can prove I'm wrong, for a little while, so it's a little safer than most of the other things that I do. And actually, you know, so the book came out at the beginning of this year and was written obviously before the ascendancy of Mr. T. So
Mr. T. No, Mr. T's too cool.
Yeah, no, he knew so much.
We won't contaminate that name. But yes, the giant orange fellow. And so some of my opinions about the future are more in flux, I suppose, than they used to be. At the time I was writing this book, I was looking back on, you know, the fact that we've moved towards, as you say, not a completed journey, but towards much greater inclusion of interracial relationships, towards much greater inclusion of same-sex love. And so I was thinking, you know, what's going to happen next? Because at the moment, there's a massive, massive head of steam behind the idea that you're supposed to be with one person forever. That's working out for some people, but not for a very, very large number of people.
Right.
And so I was predicting some kind of release valve for that problem. And one of the release valves for that problem is more tolerance of polyamory and non-monogamy in general. Mm-hmm. But when I look at that option, I see such a lot of still quite violent and, you know, vitriolic hatred. And it comes from across the political spectrum in such a way that even people who would otherwise consider themselves to be very liberal or open-minded about love and same-sex relationships and so on, that I'm not actually super optimistic about that. I would love to be optimistic about that, but I'm not. And so what I actually end up predicting is that the way that that particular head of steam might get relieved is through greater tolerance and acceptance of deliberately temporary but monogamous relationships. And part of my reason for predicting that is because that model is consistent with what I suspect is still one of the deeply buried deep core norms of how romanticness has gotten itself into our ideology, and that has to do with ownership, possession of another person. Mm-hmm. And the thing about temporary monogamy is you only have to shift from a like purchase model to a rental model, but you still accommodate the fact that you have rights now over another person.
Yeah.
Whereas the thing about non-monogamy that I think is really what might be at the heart of this very kind of deep and vitriolic reaction to it is that it challenges that, because there are so many models, so infinitely many possible models that non-monogamous relationships can take, and so many of them obviously give rise to direct challenges to the idea that romantic love is possessing another person, or, you know, putting your little wall around them and saying that's my person in here and nobody else is allowed to have that person, just me. And so there's something I think about the deeply now buried, but still, I think, really ideologically powerful idea of ownership or possession that makes me suspect that the way we might go is deliberately temporary monogamy instead of greater acceptance of non-monogamy. But I'm going to be trying my best to push us in the other direction.
Well, it makes sense that that would be an easier pill to swallow. I already feel like I have so many of my friends who identify as monogamous who are already on that train of like, why can't it be like my cell phone contract? Like, let's do 5 years with an option to renew. Like, I feel like that's already kind of creeping into the cultural psyche a little bit.
It totally is. And I mean, in some ways it totally makes sense, right? Because it's not unromantic to say, well, we'll check in 5 years and then I can recommit to you and it'll be lovely.
Yeah, exactly. Right. And
we have some friends who do it every year, actually. Yeah. On their anniversary, they're like, so do you want to renew for another year? Like, that's part of their thing, yeah.
And that can be really sweet and lovely too.
Right.
But I think it makes sense for our generation of being a generation that went through our parents' divorces. Like, so, like I think that ours is a generation that has a much easier time accepting, like, okay, maybe one person for your entire life isn't the acceptable model. Like, maybe I can accept this serial monogamy. Because, like, a lot of people can really relate to serial monogamy.
Right, they've seen it modeled.
Exactly.
And it worked.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, I feel like the trick is getting over the idea that it's failed somehow, if that's the case. Because I feel like while I do think people now are more okay with the idea of serial monogamy or just kind of like, yeah, a relationship might end and I might move on, but they still, I think, see it a little bit as a failure.
Yeah.
That's right.
Because there is still this idea that if you had done it right,
well, there's still this idea of if that person really was the one.
Right.
You know, like, it's like, no, I guess they weren't the one. Like, that's why it ended. Like, there is still that.
Yeah. Yes. So I think that needs to get pulled apart next, maybe.
Yeah. Yeah, the power of the one, I think, would be.
Seriously.
That's huge.
Yeah. So with the conversations that we've had after reading the book and like the, you know, what you brought up earlier in this interview is, you know, when we really start to pick apart what defines romantic love and if I might feel certain things, but in society that isn't considered romantic love, or, you know, and we've seen this through history of people who would have what we would today define as romantic love for a same-sex person, but they couldn't even see it that way, and so they called it something else, right? There's all of this, and it kind of led us to the question, and we are allowed to use naughty language on this show. It led us to the question of, like, is it all just bullshit? Like, is this whole notion of romantic love just a bunch of crap and we should do away with it? And instead, like, we can have love and we can have sexual attraction and we can have commitment, but why do we need this romantic love at all?
Great question. This is one I grapple with in the book, you know, and it's one that philosophers, especially like feminist philosophers, have been grappling with that question for ages, because they have identified particularly the ways in which like damaging gender roles get packed into the idea of romantic love. Yeah. And so, you know, you go back to like Simone de Beauvoir or Shulamith Firestone, like a little bit later, 40s and 70s, kind of taking both sides of that question, actually. So Shulamith Firestone, 1970s, arguing romantic love is like a diseased form of love. It's been corrupted by its power context. And she's talking about the power dynamics between men and women. Interestingly, it's the 1970s, so she's still defining romantic love as love between men and women at that stage. So, you know, you can see in many ways how these things change so quickly. But so she's saying, you know, ditch it. It's broken. Like, we need better forms of love than this. And romanticism is basically a tool of patriarchal oppression. Go back to Simone de Beauvoir in The Second Sex, and she's arguing, she has just a chapter called The Woman in Love, and she argues there that yes, it's super broken, but you can fix it. There's nothing about like the love, the romantic love per se, that can't be done between men and women as equals. But she is, you know, she is very, very unhappy about the kind of romantic love between men and women that she sees around her, for both parties, actually. So, you know, it's easy to see how she's obviously, seeing this as destructive for women. She sees women as being expected to subsume their entire personalities, their selves, their agency right. under a man's. And that's kind of deadly. She's an existentialist philosopher, so right, agency and autonomy are everything for her. But then she says, you know, it's actually really deadly for the male role in that too, because he's then expected to be this kind of godlike figure who could make it worth subsuming your entire, giving up your entire life and identity. And of course, no man ever fulfills that role, because that's an unreasonable expectation, and so you get this depression and despair and worse. And so, right. you know, it's like, it's deadly for everyone, it's completely toxic. But there's just a very, very short line at the end of the chapter where she says that when men and women can love as equals, then love will be, you know, a source of life and not mortal peril, which is what it currently is. And so I kind of do end up with de Beauvoir on this. And I do say love, even romantic love, is fixable. And this is where I talk about the buffet model. So de Beauvoir doesn't tell us an awful lot about how to get there. But I, part of why I bring in the buffet model, as a way of saying, I mean, what we're ultimately going to be doing there is partly defusing the loadedness of the label romantic, God, and this idea that it makes a certain kind of love special and privileged above everything else.
Right.
So actually, I think a word that hasn't come up yet is amato normativity.
Yeah, yeah.
And I do want to get
to that. We brought it up on our podcast
too.
Before, but
yeah, but you also talk about it in your book.
It's a good word to talk about. And this is that idea that romantic love, particularly the sort of traditional dyadic, monogamous, etc., romantic love is the best kind of love. And anyone whose life is lacking that is living, you know, in some sense, a failed or imperfect life. And that idea is part of the problem. And this, you know, once we've ditched that and we're prepared to say romantic love is just one of a suite of really valuable kinds of relationships and love that you can have in your life, among others, then I don't have a problem with romantic love anymore, right? As long as it's chosen, it's freely chosen, it's a label that we acknowledge, has a lot more flexibility than just the boy meets girl, chases girl around with a ghetto blaster and is really annoying for 5 years until she eventually concedes, and then somehow that's supposed to be happy ever after. So as long as we acknowledge that there's more than one romantic story, and it's much more flexibility, and that it's not the best kind of thing that life has to offer for everybody, although it might be for some people, then, you know, I'm fine with that.
Yeah. Well, we really like the buffet model because it reminds us a lot of relationship anarchy without having to call it anarchy, essentially. Because that's always been the thing that's kind of turned us off about the label, is people have such a negative associations with the idea anarchy, that it's a free-for-all, that it's just crazy. Right. Like, no one knows what to expect. But this idea of that it's like a choose-your-own-adventure, that it's like a buffet, that it is like, you know, the person you co-parent with doesn't have to be your number one sexual partner, doesn't have to be your best friend.
It's like a Build-A-Bear workshop.
Build-A-Bear.
I love that.
Oh my goodness. I wish I thought of that.
Oh my goodness. But I guess what I wanted to know, because as I mentioned, like, this has sparked so many conversations, not only in this relationship, but in my other relationships as well. Has writing this book and has doing this research changed the way that you approach your current relationships or new relationships?
I mean, it kind of has. In some ways, you know, while I was going through the process of writing and thinking, I was taking both of my partners with me through that process, because they are both my interlocutors. You know, they're with me in these thought processes and feeling through and thinking through all of these things. And actually, both of them read the entire manuscript of the book. And so one of the things that changed was I felt immense gratitude to both of them for, like, helping me. Because my husband is a philosopher like I am, he was able to, like, spot all the silly philosophy mistakes and, like, help me with the arguments and that sort of thing. And my boyfriend is a writer and poet, and he's taught creative writing for many years. So, you know, me kind of, like, wading out into the world of writing for non-academics for the first time, he was able to, like, go through the whole manuscript line by line and say, yeah, normal people don't talk like this. You need to rephrase
that. That's great.
This doesn't sound good. And so it was just an amazing process to work through with both of them. And, you know, it's been it's made me feel like the luckiest person in the world to have that kind of support, and it's definitely made me feel stronger and more connected to them. Recently, like since the book's come out and we've had lots more publicity going on, it's put a lot of pressure on all of us, like together, because, you know, for things like interviews that are sucking up a lot of our time, and in some ways are quite invasive of our privacy, yeah. or like are attempting to be invasive of our privacy yeah, in some cases.
Yeah.
It happens, and, you know, they're both being unbelievably supportive and generous in making this happen together with me. And so it's kind of, there's another kind of bond there now, which is this sort of, oh my goodness, the mainstream yeah. is looking at us. And what do we do? And how do we respond and react to that? And there is a kind of feeling of teamwork, I think, against all of the pressures that are coming in there.
That's nice. Excellent. I feel like that happens with a lot of quote-unquote polycules, because it's so easy to put media attention on it. Like, it's so easy for the local Channel 3 to find the local triad, you know, and ask them a billion right. questions. Like, I feel like that happens a lot. I know that's definitely happened in our own lives. Like, anytime right. there's any kind of sensationalist media attention, that it really does get exhausting right. that constantly trying to, like, not only put on a good face, but also put on like an honest face at the same time, right. and try to make sure that your story's not getting misconstrued.
Right,
right. Like and being aware of what you can and can't share is really, yes. like, you know, you have yeah. to keep updating all the time. It's like poly communication times, you know, an extra few orders of magnitude.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, for us, with the three of us who host this, we also have to battle that assumption that we're a triad. That the three of us are all dating each other. And it's a hard thing, because on the one hand, we want to be like, no, we're not the same as all that. Look, this can look different ways.
Right.
It's kind of like we talked about with the sex negativity thing. Like, it's hard to not argue too far, because we want to be like, well, we all were when we started the podcast. But since then, you know, now our other host, Emily, isn't dating either of us anymore. But we all still have other relationships. But then at the same time, I want to be like, but we're actually like even more in love than we were before. It just doesn't look like that kind of romantic love. So it's this whole, just like your book explores, where it's like,
you're podcast co-parents.
It is a lot like that. We call ourselves like an emotional triad.
There you go.
Like, there's just not like a sexual or romantic, whatever that means, aspect to it.
But it is that, you're kind of on display. And so there's this pressure to get across all the things you think are important. Right.
Yeah, it's tough and it's exhausting, and, you know, I kind of I feel like immensely grateful to both of them for being willing to go through that with me, you know, because it was really, you know, this is a book that I wrote, and it's me sort of trying to get a bunch of ideas out there. I actually personally hate being out there myself, because I'm a little introvert, and I actually kind of naturally kind of prefer to just hide in a room with my laptop and write. You know, that's what I do. I write. I'm a writer.
Right.
But there's this part of the job where that becomes necessary, and so, you know, working to accommodate that.
So we're coming to the end of our time, and we have one question that we ask of all of our guests, and so we'll ask you, if you're going to give one piece of advice to someone who's considering opening up their relationship or becoming non-monogamous or exploring polyamory, what's the one piece of advice you would give?
Oh my goodness.
Other than read my book.
Read my book. No, but I really struggle with this one, because I'm not an advice giver by nature. And so, you know, this sounds like I'm going to weasel out of the question, but I'm going to give you an explanation of why that is, partly as a sort of partial recompense for not answering the question. And the part of it is that I feel so strongly that I'm enmeshed in a particular position and situation, and view of all of these things, relationships, love, sex, whatever it is, that the best, you know, the best I might be able to do is imagine some sort of either version of me looking from a different position on things, which is not what anybody else is going to be, or, you know, some sort of tabula rasa, like blank slate, which is unimaginable, because then there's nothing there. And so, you know, the only thing I get that's sort of close to a form of advice is resisting scripts, and challenging them and understanding where the messaging is coming from that says you have to do this or you have to do that or you should or you'll be happier if you did this. Because like all of those messages are coming at us from every direction all the time. And so eventually they're coming at us from our own minds as well, because that's how internalization works. Mm-hmm. And so it's easy, even with things that, you know, that we think come from ourselves, that we think we want, it's even worth challenging and questioning those, because there's a decent chance that they might have been put there by something or someone else just so long ago that you've forgotten how it got in there in the first place. So, I mean, it's not advice in any kind of
that's absolutely advice.
Classic sense.
No, but you weren't going to give advice.
No, that's fantastic. No, that's fantastic.
There you go.
Beautiful. And so then the last thing is just where can people find your book and find out more about you? And maybe even like where we can find lists of your academic writings and stuff like that.
Sure. So if you go to my webpage, which is www.carriejenkins.net, then on the various tabs there, you'll be able to find my book and some of the reviews. And there's also a link to academic work. And so you can go into and you can find those papers that I was talking about from there as well. If you want to follow me on Twitter, I'm at Carrie Jenkins on Twitter. I am on Facebook as well. I'm Carrie Jenkins on Facebook, but I might not be the only one there. So it might be easier to find me via the webpage first, and then there should be links through to my social media from there.
And then on your site, there's links for everything, right? For your book and for articles and all that.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. And the book should be, it's on Amazon. It should be also, go buy it from your local bookstore if you have one of those, and you should be able to get hold of it.
Excellent. Well, awesome. Well, thank you so much for being here, Carrie.
Thank you.
So, guys, go out there, check out our stuff. If you want to listen to more of our podcast, you can find us at multiamory.com. You can email us at info@multiamory. You can find us on Twitter @multiamory. You can join our Patreon at patreon.com/multiamory. Is that all the things?
It's just multiamory everywhere.
Just Google multiamory. You'll find it. Yeah.
You got a strong brand there.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you all so much. Thank you, Carrie and everyone. We will see you next week.
See ya.
All right. Bye-bye.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry. Sorry. We're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No. Lucky Land Casino. With cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.